You are listening to the Gable Media Continuing Education podcast feed, the most entertaining and convenient way for AEC professionals to get continuing education credits, including AIA-approved courses. As a Gable member, just listen and follow the link in the show notes to take a brief quiz and obtain your credit today. Enjoy.
On May 14, 1948, the Allied powers allocated land from British-controlled Palestine to establish the first Jewish state in 2,000 years. Thunderous sounds of gunfire erupted as British troops withdrew, and the next day, forces from Egypt, Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq invaded. This conflict has deep roots, tracing back to ancient times. A large area in the eastern Mediterranean, including parts of today's Libya, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, Greece, and Iraq, was known as the Levant. Within the Levant were the historical kingdoms of Israel and Judah, established around 1200 to 600 BC, which are considered the origins of the Jewish people. The earliest mention of Israel appears on an ancient Egyptian inscription from around 1208 BCE. Archaeological evidence suggests that ancient Israelite culture evolved from the Canaanite civilization. The kingdoms fell to Assyria and Babylonian empires, leading to exile and the Jewish diaspora. Over millennia, controls of this region changed hands repeatedly as the Jewish population migrated to various areas in Central and Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. Jewish culture thrived briefly in Spain, but was soon forced to leave, only to repeat the cycle in Italy. As they arrived in Poland in the 18th century, some historians believe that an increasingly tense atmosphere between Jews and Europeans may have initiated the idea that Jewish population couldn't survive if it didn't have a nation of its own. By the early 20th century, the Ottoman Empire, or Turkish Empire, had taken control of much of the Levant, including through horrific events like the Armenian Genocide, where 1.5 million Armenians died through massacre, forced labor, and death marches into the Syrian desert. Internal conflict was growing within the empire, and under the backdrop of the First World War, Arab peoples separately revolted against the Ottoman Empire. With the assistance of the British, the Ottoman Empire was forced out. The United Kingdom took control under the premise of honoring Arab independence. However, the UK and France divided the area. The British issued the Balfour Declaration in 1917, supporting a Jewish homeland. The League of Nations formalized this when it mandated Britain to govern the area that they designated Mandatory Palestine, which stretched from the western border of Egypt to the eastern border of Jordan and up to the southern border of Lebanon. Jewish people slowly began migrating to the area, but relationships between Jewish and Arab communities grew contentious. Meanwhile, in German-occupied Europe, where more than 9 million Jewish people still lived in 1933, Nazi Germany and its collaborators systematically murdered some 6 million Jews, Romani people, political dissidents, and homosexuals between 1941 and 1945. Spurring illegal immigration to Mandatory Palestine. Post-World War II, Britain referred the matter to the United Nations, which voted to partition Mandatory Palestine into Jewish and Arab states in 1947, the State of Israel, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, which annexed territory on the west bank of the Jordan River, and the Kingdom of Egypt, which established the All-Palestine Protectorate in the Gaza Strip. Conflict persisted, highlighted by Israel, along with France and the United Kingdom, attacking Egypt in 1956 in an attempt to seize the Suez Canal and overthrow Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, Israel's attack and occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip in 1967, and the 1973 Yom Kippur War when Egypt and Syria attacked Israel. The United States was the first country to recognize the nascent state of Israel. Since the 1960s, the American-Israeli relationship grew into a mutually beneficial alliance in economic, strategic, and military aspects. During the Cold War, Israel was a valuable partner in countering Soviet influence in the region. One senator even referred to Israel as the equivalent of a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Middle East. The partnership has been vital, later exemplified by then-Senator Joe Biden's May 1986 remarks to the U.S. Senate.
I think it's about time we stop those of us who support, as most of us do, Israel in this body, for apologizing for our support for Israel. There's no apology to be made. None. It is the best $3 billion investment we make. Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region. The United States would have to go out and invent an Israel. I am with my colleagues who are on the floor in the Foreign Relations Committee, and we worry at length about NATO. And we worry about the eastern flank of NATO, Greece and Turkey, and how important it is. They pale by comparison.
In kind, the U.S. and its allies often supported Israel through Arab-Israeli conflicts. In response, the Organization of Arab Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, launched an oil embargo against them, contributing to a global energy crisis that affected the U.S. economy for years.
Because people are not buying big cars, General Motors, the biggest car manufacturer in the world, will cut production this month by 80,000 cars.
It is a crisis of such proportion that we probably haven't even begun to grasp it yet as far as the country is concerned. I have said to myself and to others that this is a Pearl Harbor again as far as the United States is concerned, because of the fact that it envisions a whole change in our lifestyle, a whole change in the way this country has been built. And I think that there's no question but what our national leadership and the economic leadership, the business community leadership of our country is one that has really let us down, because they've taken us along with the idea that they're going to use that last drop of oil and they're going to use that last bit of metal in order to make the last dollar of profit.
I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Going Green.
I'm in a line 2 hours in. I can't get gas. This is baloney. Carter doesn't get my vote next year.
People here in Washington involved in the public policy process, like the Congress, officials in the executive branch, leaders in the national news media, have to depend on ideas as the raw material for everything they do. And it's those new ideas that think tanks in Washington are involved in presenting to the public policymakers.
This season, we've explored significant historical and environmental events, starting with Thomas Newcomen's steam engine and its role in the Industrial Revolution. We've discussed the transformation of the American landscape, the environmental awakening triggered by Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and the architectural evolution from modernism to postmodernism. If you haven't listened to the previous episodes, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. Geopolitical strife and the environmental and energy crises were intimately connected in the 1970s and 80s. President Jimmy Carter's energy policies and President Reagan's deregulation era highlighted the complex interplay between politics, environmentalism, and global challenges. This would be a defining period for humanity's relationship with the environment, and I'll get into that after this break. Episode 5, Greed is Good. On January 20th, 1977, Jimmy Carter was sworn in as the 39th President of the United States during a period of stagflation marked by high inflation and slow economic growth. The stock market had lost nearly 50% of its value over 20 months. Weak economic growth led to rising unemployment. Low interest, easy money policies of the previous administration resulted in high inflation, and a growing energy crisis was top of mind for many Americans. After the oil embargo, gasoline prices spiked by 37%.
In this outward and physical ceremony, we attest once again to the inner and spiritual strength of our nation. As my high school teacher, Miss Judy Coleman, used to say, we must adjust to changing times and still hold to unchanging principles.
Many thought the OPEC oil embargo was the sole reason for the crisis, but there was much more at play. In the mid-20th century, U.S. coal usage was surpassed by petroleum and natural gas as the dominant energy sources. Throughout the 1960s, the federal government and state agencies maintained control over the oil market, setting prices and managing imports and domestic production. This regulatory framework created a balance, keeping oil prices cheap, which benefited a rapidly growing auto industry that consumed 40% of the nation's oil. However, by the late 1960s, this equilibrium began to falter. Special exemptions and tax benefits for oil production undermined federal import controls, and domestic oil production capacity was nearing its limit, raising fears of energy scarcity. Internationally, rising consumption tightened global oil markets, with U.S. consumption increasing by 51% during the decade. In 1971, President Nixon imposed wage and price controls, freezing gasoline prices at seasonal highs and creating a disincentive for heating oil production. Although the freeze was lifted in November, oil prices remained regulated. By 1972, the U.S. faced a severe heating oil shortage as crude oil supplies dwindled.
End is out of oil.
How much have you got left in there?
None. It's empty. There is no oil. There's none to get. And they can't deliver any.
So what are you going to do?
There's nothing that we can do right at the moment until we just have to resort to some other source of heat.
You worried?
You're damn right. And when you got babies, you gotta have to worry.
Did you ever think that this kind of thing would
happen? No way. No. Not really. There's no reason for it to be, that I can see. Do you know of any reason?
No, we discussed putting in wood heat this summer, and we thought it was all a big farce, so we didn't try. And then when we tried to find a wood heater, there were none to find.
You mean you didn't take the warning seriously?
No. I just couldn't imagine something like this would happen in America.
Despite Nixon authorizing increased imports, major oil companies imported only a fraction of the allowed amount and kept refineries running below capacity, leading to the first peacetime petroleum shortage in U.S. history. Industry leaders blamed government policies, but internal documents suggested that companies deliberately limited production. As demand surged, major oil companies resisted expanding refinery capacity, contributing to the shortages. The Federal Trade Commission accused them of collusion, alleging they manipulated the market to maintain high crude prices and suppress competition from independent refiners. The resulting shortages and rising profits led to suspicions of monopolistic practices, with the FTC filing an antitrust case. In response to the energy crisis, new legislation, including the Emergency Petroleum Allocation Act of 1973 and the Energy Policy and Conservation Act of 1975, or EPCA, empowered the president to regulate petroleum products allocation and pricing, reflecting the growing need to reassess America's reliance on fossil fuels.
Your partial access code is zero. Your partial access code is zero.
And living like ostriches, you know, and we use more than our share of the natural resources. We know this. But, I don't know. We kind of thought it was going to go on forever.
By 1977, energy policy was a significant challenge for the United States. The Carter administration enacted a national energy policy for long-term conservation and alternative resources. He called for energy conservation, increased use of U.S. coal reserves and controlled nuclear power expansion. His goals included limiting energy demand growth, cutting oil imports, and establishing a strategic petroleum reserve. Carter created the Department of Energy to oversee national energy policy and production, nuclear power research, military nuclear weapons, reactor production for the Navy, and energy conservation. The first DOE energy plan included 113 provisions, focusing on taxes on domestic oil production and gasoline consumption, tax credits for energy conservation, and mandates to convert from oil or natural gas to coal power. The House approved much of Carter's plan, but the Senate passed a watered-down version. Carter signed the National Energy Act in November 1978, deregulating natural gas and encouraging energy conservation and renewable energy development through tax credits. Another energy shortage hit the United States in 1979, forcing millions of frustrated motorists into long waits at gasoline stations.
People ought to just take their cars, put them in their garages, and let them sit there. Let the stations, the owners, the oil companies choke on their gas.
What is this? I'm in the line 2 hours in. I can't get gas. This is baloney. Carter doesn't get my vote next year.
Tell that goddamn governor he's going to police this goddamn gasoline situation. I will not take the blame for this thing. I will not take the crap and the harassment from these customers. Now let him police it or stop selling gas.
Look, this lady, Ed.
I'm not talking to anybody. You get the governor down here, let him worry about how he's going to sell this gasoline. The dealers will not be subjected to this harassment.
We'll get gas when you'll be, this afternoon you'll be able to charge perhaps.
I'll bet you there's no gas, even at that price. What do you think of that?
I heard this morning.
Well, you get the gas
the
down.
Commissioner
here.
Of Energy from Washington, and they
what
claim there's gas.
Make a living? What about?
I mean, this is ridiculous.
I have to travel. I can go on disability. I got to wear blue slit braces. What does a person like myself do?
To turn you down the land? Why didn't they come out and tell us there was no gas? No, they did not.
Eight o'clock. Were you supposed to pump at 8 o'clock? It's a quarter to nine. What are you doing in line? In line? A quarter to nine. You're only supposed to pump to 8 o'clock.
I have to be at work at 8. I came here at 6:30. 6:30?
And you expect to get gas at 6:30 in line? Forget it, lady.
Just shut down.
In response, Carter asked Congress to deregulate domestic oil prices, which were set by complex price controls. Oil companies favored deregulation, but some Congress members worried about inflation. A Gallup poll in late April and early May found only 14% believed America faced an actual energy shortage, while 77% thought oil companies manufactured it for profit. Carter paired deregulation with a windfall profits tax, returning about half of the new profits to the federal government. He phased in oil controls using the EPCA, but Congress balked at implementing the proposed tax. In July 1979, Carter met with leaders to overhaul his administration's policies. His pollster, Pat Caddell, told him the American people faced a crisis of confidence from the assassinations of major U.S. political leaders, the Vietnam War, and the Watergate scandal. On July 15th, Carter delivered a televised speech calling for long-term limits on oil imports and synthetic fuels development, stating, quote,
"All the legislation in the world can't fix what's wrong with America. What is lacking is confidence and a sense of community."
The speech was named a crisis of confidence.
We ourselves are the same Americans who just 10 years ago put a man on the moon. We are the generation that dedicated our society to the pursuit of human rights and equality. And we are the generation that will win the war on the energy problem. And in that process, rebuild the unity and confidence of America. We are at a turning point in our history. There are two paths to choose. One is a path I've warned about tonight. the path that leads to fragmentation and self-interest. Down that road lies a mistaken idea of freedom, the right to grasp for ourselves some advantage over others. That path would be one of constant conflict between narrow interest, ending in chaos and immobility. It is a certain route to failure. All the traditions of our past, all the lessons of our heritage, all the promises of our future point to another path, the path of common purpose and the restoration of American values. That path leads to true freedom for our nation and ourselves. We can take the first steps down that path as we begin to solve our energy problem. Energy will be the immediate test of our ability to unite this nation. And it can also be the standard around which we rally. On the battlefield of energy, we can win for our nation a new confidence, and we can seize control again of our common destiny.
Following the speech, Congress approved a $227 billion windfall profit tax and passed the Energy Security Act, establishing the Synthetic Fuels Corporation. Carter's policies contributed to a 10% decrease in per capita energy consumption from 1979 to 1983. Oil imports, which had reached a record 2.4 billion barrels in 1977, declined by half from 1979 to 1983. Aside from energy reform, Carter supported many environmentalist goals, signing bills like the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977, which regulates strip mining, established Superfund, a federal program designed to clean up mining or factory sites contaminated with hazardous substances, and the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which withdrew over 100 million acres of public domain land in Alaska from commercial use to be designated as conservation areas, doubling public land set aside for national parks and wildlife refuges. During this period, unbeknownst to the public, the American Petroleum Institute, the largest U.S. trade association for the oil and natural gas industry, had formed a secret committee called the CO2 and Climate Task Force, which included representatives of many of the major oil companies. The group privately monitored and discussed the latest developments in climate science. ExxonMobil had also launched its own private research program in 1977 to sample carbon dioxide and build up rigorous climate models. Top scientists and a more than $1 million tanker project to study how much CO2 is absorbed by the oceans were committed to this ambitious research program. With shocking accuracy, Exxon's models predicted the climate conditions that we see today. In 2003, Harvard scientists used the established Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, statistical techniques to test the performance of Exxon's models. They found that, depending on the metric used, 63 to 83% of the global warming projections reported by Exxon scientists were consistent with actual temperatures over time. A skill score relates to how well a forecast compares to what happens in real life. The corporation's projections had an average skill score of 72%, plus or minus 6%, with the highest scoring 99%. An Exxon senior scientist, James Black, told Exxon's management committee, quote,
"In the first place, there is general scientific agreement that the most likely manner in which mankind is influencing the global climate is through carbon dioxide release from the burning of fossil fuels. Present thinking holds that man has a time window of 5 to 10 years before the need for hard decisions regarding changes in energy strategies might become critical."
End quote. In 1981, one of Exxon's managers, Roger Cohen, sent an internal memo observing that the company's long-term business plans could, quote, produce effects which will indeed be catastrophic, at least for a substantial fraction of the Earth's population, end quote. The next year, Exxon completed a comprehensive 40-page report on climate change, which predicted the climate events that we've already seen: sea level rise, droughts, and more. According to the front page of the report, it was, quote, given wide circulation to Exxon management, but was not to be distributed externally. While knowledge of the effects became definitive in the late 70s and early 80s, the oil and natural gas industry suspected as much even earlier. At an annual meeting in 1965, a speech from Frank Eichard, an oil executive and president of the American Petroleum Institute, referenced a report called Restoring the Quality of Our Environment. Eichard shared with the audience,
"The substance of the report is that there is still time to save the world's peoples from the catastrophic consequences of pollution, but time is running out. One of the most important predictions of the report is that carbon dioxide is being added to the Earth's atmosphere by the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas at such a rate that by the year 2000, the heat balance will be so modified as possibly to cause marked changes in climate."
Eichard also noted that the report found that, quote, non-polluting means of powering automobiles, buses, and trucks is likely to become a national necessity, end quote. Even before that, a transcript from a petroleum conference in 1959 called the Energy and Man Symposium showed a speech from Edward Teller, a scientist who helped invent the hydrogen bomb. Teller warned,
"Whenever you burn conventional fuel, you create carbon dioxide. Its presence in the atmosphere causes a greenhouse effect."
He went on to explain that if the world kept using fossil fuels, the ice caps would begin to melt, raising sea levels. Eventually, quote, all the coastal cities would be covered, end quote. Now, in 1979, with a definitive understanding of the situation, internal documents showed that Exxon privately studied options for avoiding global warming. They found that by immediately transitioning from fossil fuels to renewable energy, fossil fuel pollution could start to decline in the 1990s, and a major climate crisis could be avoided. Instead, there was a decision to engage in a coordinated global effort to dispute climate science and block fossil fuel controls. The approaching 1980 election was pivotal, with Carter running for a second term against Ronald Reagan, former governor of California, and Republican Congressman John B. Anderson, who launched an independent campaign for president. The makeup of the electorate changed behind two events that particularly motivated evangelicals to engage more in this election: the 1973 Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade, and the 1970 removal of tax-exempt status for Bob Jones University, a religious university that excluded Black students from admissions. Reagan appealed to the rising conservative movement that not only advocated cutting taxes and budget deficits, but also focused more closely on social issues like abortion and homosexuality. Evangelicals enthusiastically supported Reagan. He called for increased defense spending behind Cold War concerns, tax cuts, domestic spending cuts, and the dismantling of the Department of Education and the Department of Energy. Carter didn't think there was a chance that the American people would choose that platform. However, the inability to turn around the economy within his term left some to perceive the administration as incompetent. Furthermore, the negative attitudes many people held towards all three candidates led many to stay at home as voter turnout reached its lowest point since the 1948 presidential election. The candidate with the most dedicated base, Reagan, went on to win 50.7% of the popular vote, carrying all but a handful of states. At the turn of the decade, much of the youth movement that was so integral to the social and environmental change in the U.S. through the 1960s and 70s had moved further into adulthood, where priorities changed. The 1980s marked a shift in cultural norms, with society embracing materialism and individualism, moving towards what would be known as the decade of decadence, or the era of excess. This shift in ethos is succinctly epitomized in the iconic scene from the 1987 film Wall Street, where corporate raider Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas, speaks at an annual shareholders meeting of a company he's planning to take over.
The new law of evolution in corporate America seems to be survival of the unfittest. Well, in my book, you either do it right or you get eliminated. In the last seven deals that I've been involved with, there were 2.5 million stockholders who have made a pre-tax profit of $12 billion. Thank you. I am not a destroyer of companies. I am a liberator of them. The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Gekko compares the United States to a, quote, malfunctioning corporation that greed could still save. Reagan, too, viewed the free market as the best judge of what was good for the country. He felt that corporate self-interests would steer the country in the right direction. In his first term, Reagan implemented what would be known as Reaganomics, an economic policy based on deregulation and cuts in both taxes and government spending on public welfare.
Your partial access code is R. Your partial access code is R.
To appreciate the implications of tax plans, you should know that since 1913, when the U.S. introduced the federal income tax, the country has used a system called a marginal tax structure. This means that as you earn more money, you move into higher tax brackets, and your income is taxed at different rates depending on how much you make. The intent is to tax individuals based on their earnings so that low-income earners do not face a financially disproportionate burden compared to higher-income earners. Income is divided into parts or tiers. The higher the income, the more the tiers, and each tier is taxed at a higher rate. The highest tier, or tax bracket, you reach is called your marginal tax rate. However, the average rate you pay on all your income is usually much lower than your marginal tax rate. This average rate is known as your effective tax rate. Now, the top marginal tax rate has varied over time, starting at 7% in 1913, it rose to 77% by 1918. It declined to as low as 24% in the 20s and increased through the Great Depression, topping out at 91 to 92% from 1951 to 1963, which notably was the period of the lowest income inequality in documented U.S. history. Through the 70s, the top marginal tax rate dropped to the 70% range until Reagan's first tax cut in 1981. Reagan lowered the marginal tax rate to 50%. The rate would drop again to a staggering 28% on his way out from his second term. A multimillionaire who was paying $700,000 in taxes in the 1970s saw their taxes reduced to $350,000 in the 1980s. While the rate cut was marketed to trickle down through the economy through consumption and reinvestment into the workforce, Some use their savings to fund the transformation of policies in their favor through various means. Economists were hired to support ideologies. Media outlets were purchased to control messaging. The extra money also bought influence with politicians and shaped laws. The tax cuts for the ultra-wealthy arguably contributed to a cycle that disproportionately increased their own wealth and influence. When it came to cuts in government spending, one targeted area was environmental policy. The 1980 Republican platform reaffirmed a commitment to conservation, but emphasized reviewing and reforming environmental laws. In the fall of 1980, Reagan appointed a transition task force on the environment to produce specific reform suggestions. Chaired by Dan Lefkin, a former head of Connecticut's Department of Environmental Protection, the task force also included two former EPA administrators, Russell Train and William Ruckelshaus. It produced a report calling for moderate reforms in line with the Republican platform, but did not advocate cutting programs on a wholesale basis to maintain momentum of environmental protection. Now, as the governor of California, Reagan had a strong environmental record, but in the White House, his environmental policy took a dramatic turn, even diverging from his party's platform. The Lefkin report was largely ignored, as the president's environmental policy agenda was now being shaped more by the views of the Heritage Foundation. Founded in 1973 by Paul Weyrich, a religious conservative political activist, Edwin Fulner, a former congressional aide and foreign consultant, and Joseph Coors of Coors Brewing Company, the Heritage Foundation is an activist American conservative think tank based in Washington, D.C.
Hello, I'm Ed Fulner, president of the Heritage Foundation, a Washington-based public policy research organization that is a think tank. Think tanks are basically idea factories, and we're in the idea business because we believe that ideas have consequences, or as John Maynard Keynes, the economist, said, it is ideas, not vested interests, which are dangerous for good or evil. Ideas basically are the raw materials of laws, which means that people here in Washington involved in the public policy process, like the Congress, officials in the executive branch, leaders in the national news media, have to depend on ideas as the raw material for everything they do. And it's those new ideas that think tanks in Washington are involved in presenting to the public policymakers. Our ideas here at Heritage are usually described as conservative. That is, we believe in promoting traditional American values, we believe in a strong national defense, and we believe in the free enterprise system and free trade. We believe that basically less government is better than more government.
But you're talking about ideas, Ed. I assume you're talking about ideas transferred to action.
Indeed. The idea by itself is not enough. We think of, in the public policy arena, the three I's: ideas, individuals, and institutions. The idea is the first basic raw material that begins the process. But that idea then has to be articulated by an individual, and that individual has to then make it happen and make it relevant, if you will, to the public policymakers, and that usually happens through an institution.
Growing out of the new business activist movement that was inspired by discontent with Richard Nixon's embrace of the liberal consensus and frustration with the non-controversial nature of existing think tanks, Weyrich and Fulner sought to advance conservative policies through their own version of a think tank. In its early years, Coors was the Heritage Foundation's primary funding source, contributing $250,000, and continued to fund it through the Adolph Coors Foundation. ExxonMobil has been another prominent funding source. The foundation's trustees have historically included individuals affiliated with Chase Manhattan Bank, Dow Chemical, General Motors, Mobil, Pfizer, Sears, and other corporations. The Heritage Foundation advocated for pro-business policies but distinguished itself by also advocating for cultural issues important to Christian conservatives. Recently, it has influenced conservative media narratives and legislative recommendations on transgender rights, critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, Ukraine funding, voter fraud claims, and climate denial. Since August 2023, the foundation has also led Project 2025, a strategic effort to reshape the executive branch if a Republican wins the 2024 presidential election. Back in 1981, the Heritage Foundation published the first edition of Mandate for Leadership, a far-reaching, detailed publication that offered specific recommendations on policy, budget, and administrative action for the incoming Reagan administration. The document was 20 volumes, 3,000 pages, and contained more than 2,000 individual suggestions to move the federal government in a conservative direction. The report presented a plan for reshaping public discourse on civil rights issues, including halting past affirmative action policies, provided specific suggestions related to spending, including raising the defense budget by $20 billion in fiscal year 1981 and increasing it by an average of $35 billion over the next 5 years, establishing urban enterprise zones to encourage businesses, often high polluters, to move into the nation's inner cities, reducing personal income tax rates by 10% across the board, calling for line item veto power by the president, and developing a new strategic bomber using B-1 and advanced bomber technology. According to Mandate's authors, around 60% of the 2,000 proposals in it were implemented or initiated at the end of Reagan's first year in office. That same year, Reagan famously asserted, quote, "trees cause more pollution than automobiles do," and that if, quote, "you've seen one tree, you've seen them all," end quote. A remarkable difference from his time in California. As a further display of his posture on climate, in his second term, Reagan removed 32 solar panels that Jimmy Carter had installed on the White House during the Arab oil embargo. The panels were removed while work was being done on the roof below the panels. Some claimed that the only reason the panels were not reinstalled was because of cost concerns. However, the Reagan administration's opposition to renewable energy was clear by this point. At his first cabinet meeting, Reagan passed out copies of Mandate for Leadership, and many of the authors were in the room. In particular, key Mandate contributor James G. Watt, who was appointed as Secretary of the Interior, a role that is responsible for the management and conservation of most federal land, along with natural resources.
While Watt was being greeted by fellow Republicans at a luncheon fundraiser, anti-Watt demonstrators were not far away. They were angry about Watt's request to take another look at possible strip mining in Utah's Alton coal fields.
Secretary Watt is sacrificing virtually every tradition, every law, and every regulation to protect our national parks, our wildlife, our endangered species, our wilderness, our clean air and water.
Later, while talking with reporters, Watt said he is merely asking for permission to consider the coal fields. He says no final decision has been made. Watt
says he is. James G. Watt was a lawyer and founding president of the Mountain States Legal Foundation, or MSLF, in Denver, a conservative group that acted on behalf of oil, timber, development, and mineral corporations. Initially funded by none other than Joseph Coors, the MSLF also took donations from some 175 corporations. MSLF was closely identified with an anti-environmental movement called Wise Use, which advocated for increased access to and development of federal lands and resources with a preference for extractive uses like mining and oil drilling, or utilitarian uses like grazing over ecological, scenic, wildlife, or aesthetic values. The group promoted so-called takings legislation, which asked that private and corporate landholders be compensated by government for having to comply with environmental laws, such as habitat protection. Watt initiated aggressive legal tactics at MSLF, filing lawsuits and pursuing pro-business legislation on the environment in a way that hadn't been done before. He maintained that his actions were for the good of the people and the free enterprise system. Watt was reportedly recommended to Reagan by Joseph Coors, who was also a leading contributor to the Reagan campaign. This appointment had major implications for the direction of environmental policy initiatives in the first 3 years of his administration. Reagan's administration made massive cuts to environmental program budgets. The Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, shaped these cuts to reinforce the president's policy change agenda. The OMB is a key component of the White House that manages the implementation of the president's vision across the federal government, overseeing the performance of federal agencies and administering the federal budget. The EPA's research and development funds were cut by more than half between 1981 and 1984. Typically, you would expect department and agency heads to protest such cuts, but Reagan appointed Ann Gorsuch, who welcomed the prospect of reduced budgets. Gorsuch, a Colorado attorney and politician, argued that states were better custodians of resources and that market forces would bring more discipline to regulation. In 1975, she was elected to the Colorado House of Representatives and served in office for two 2-year terms. She was voted Outstanding Freshman Legislator, but often aligned herself with a small but powerful group of conservatives called the, quote, House Crazies, who were determined to permanently change government through tax cuts and deregulation. After the president signed the fiscal 1983 budget for the EPA, Gorsuch said she was pleased with the result.
This was the last act of a 7-act passion play. We got essentially what we wanted.
Reagan's budget requests for environmental protection faced opposition in Congress. By 1984, the EPA's budget had fallen to levels comparable to 1972, despite increased responsibilities. Gorsuch tried to weaken pollution standards, but the Democratic House and moderate Republican Senate held numerous hearings and investigations into the administration's controversial initiatives. There is ample evidence that OMB served as a conduit for business influence on regulation and has directly attempted to change agency rulemaking. John E. Daniel, former EPA chief of staff, testified that OMB tried to dictate regulations to EPA, urged that cost factors to be considered in setting health rules when the Clean Air Act prohibited their use, threatened retaliation against the agency, and showed proposed rules changes to industry officials before they were made public. Most importantly, the entire process was closed to the public and there is no administrative record. At least one OMB official stated,
"We're not doing any heavy analysis. The economic analysis is just window dressing for the executive order."
As Reagan approached the 1984 election, he had no choice but to make some changes. Watt, when defending his widely criticized decision to authorize the sale of more than 1 billion tons of coal from federal lands in Wyoming, argued that he was immune to criticism because members of his coal advisory panel included, quote, a black, a woman, 2 Jews, and a cripple, end quote. This comment got him fired in 1983, the same year that Gorsuch was forced to resign because documents exposed by Congress revealed major misconduct within the EPA. Environmental policy had become an extremely sensitive issue for the president. To provide a sense of fairness and moderation at the Interior Department, he appointed William Clark, previously Reagan's National Security Advisor, to replace Watt.
Your partial access code is 2. Your partial access code is 2.
To restore credibility to EPA, William Ruckelshaus, the former EPA administrator from Reagan's transition task force, was brought in to replace Gorsuch. The change in style was unmistakable. Ruckelshaus and Clark adopted a conciliatory posture before Congress, held well-publicized meetings with environmental groups, and reversed several controversial decisions. OMB intended to cut the EPA's budget even more for 1984, but the administration finally backed down and accepted Ruckelshaus's recommendation to add another $165.5 million to the original EPA budget. Ruckelshaus hoped to restore EPA's budget to normal pre-1981 levels, but a fiscal crisis produced in large part by the 1981 tax reductions and increased defense budget would preclude restoration of environmental programs for the indefinite future. In addition, oil prices collapsed in the mid-1980s. Domestic oil production fell, imports increased, and progress towards energy efficiency slowed. Globally, the World Commission on Environmental and Development met for the first time in October 1984 for what would be a 900-day international exercise. The goal was to catalog, analyze, and synthesize written submissions and expert testimony from senior government representatives, scientists and experts, research institutes, industrialists, representatives of non-governmental organizations, and the public. Known today as the Brundtland Commission, a sub-organization of the United Nations, the group published a report called Our Common Future, or the Brundtland Report. The report was published in April 1987 as the global population reached 5 billion. It sought to place environmental issues firmly on the political agenda, aiming to discuss the environment and development as one single issue. Meanwhile, environmental disasters continued to pile up. A drought-triggered crisis in Africa, putting 36 million people at risk, killing an estimated 1 million people. A leak from a pesticides factory in Bhopal, India, killed more than 2,000 people and blinded and injured over 200,000 more. Liquid gas tanks exploded in Mexico City, killing 1,000 and leaving thousands more homeless. The Chernobyl nuclear reactor explosion, which sent nuclear fallout across Europe, increasing the risk of future human cancers. Agricultural chemicals, solvents, and mercury flowed into the Rhine River during a warehouse fire in Switzerland, killing millions of fish and threatening drinking water in the Federal Republic of Germany and the Netherlands. And an estimated 60 million people died of diarrheal diseases related to unsafe drinking water and malnutrition. Most of the victims were children. In 1985, in the scientific journal Nature, three scientists from the British Antarctic Survey announced the detection of abnormally low ozone levels over the South Pole, known as the ozone hole. The ozone layer is a region of the Earth's stratosphere containing high levels of trioxygen, which effectively blocks much of the sun's most harmful ultraviolet radiation. Scientists had pushed for regulating chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, found in air conditioners and aerosol sprays, due to their adverse effects on this layer. The EPA had banned CFCs in 1978, but this discovery highlighted humanity's ability to damage the Earth's atmosphere. The Nature paper specifically revealed annual depletion of ozone above the Antarctic. While the early 80s marked a significant rise in global temperatures, 1988 was pivotal due to record-breaking heat, severe droughts, and wildfires in the U.S. This period drew heightened awareness about climate change. In 1987, President Reagan had also developed a cancerous growth on the right side of his nose. Considering his love of being outside, the president may have been able to see how it was related. NASA, who initially focused on space, expanded its role in Earth science during this period. It established an Earth-observing system to explore global change, a concept encompassing climate change, land use, oceans, and pollution. In June 1988, NASA scientist James Hansen testified to Congress about the certainty of global warming. All the while, Exxon held a public stance that the science was still controversial. For comparison of the accuracy between Hansen and Exxon's prediction, Hansen's global warming predictions had skill scores from 38 to 66% compared to Exxon's 72%, with their highest score being 99%. They knew all along. Fortunately, the global response to the ozone layer's depletion was swift and decisive. Nations rallied behind the Montreal Protocol on substances that deplete the ozone layer, an international treaty designed to protect the ozone layer by phasing out the production of numerous substances that are responsible for ozone depletion. Signed by 46 nations in 1987, the treaty was unanimously ratified by the U.S. Senate in 1988, and all 197 UN members endorsed it. Scientists estimated the ozone layer would recover to pre-1980 levels by the end of the 21st century. The intertwined history of geopolitical conflicts and environmental policy underscores the complexity and interconnectedness of global challenges. From ancient territorial disputes to modern environmental crises, the decisions made by industries and nations reverberate across time and borders. In the U.S., the politicization of the EPA, deregulation, and cuts in government spending led to the loss of thousands of skilled personnel and the reduction by half or more in the research budgets of EPA and other agencies, undermining the technical and analytical capacities necessary to improve implementation of environmental programs. In the end, the national debt still nearly tripled. In Jimmy Carter's Crisis of Confidence speech, he shared a warning.
In a nation that was proud of hard work, strong families, close-knit communities, and our faith in God, too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption. Human identity is no longer defined by what one does, but by what one owns. But we've discovered that owning things and consuming things does not satisfy our longing for meaning. We've learned that piling up material goods cannot fill the emptiness of lives which have no confidence or purpose. The symptoms of this crisis of the American spirit are all around us. For the first time in the history of our country, a majority of our people believe that the next 5 years will be worse than the past 5 years. 2/3 of our people do not even vote. The productivity of American workers is actually dropping. And the willingness of Americans to save for the future has fallen below that of all other people in the Western world. As you know, there is a growing disrespect for government and for churches and for schools, the news media, and other institutions. This is not a message of happiness or reassurance, but it is the truth. And it is a warning.
Over the next decade, the long-term effects from this era of excess will ripple throughout society. Next time on Going Green.
There are lots of struggles around pesticides and farm workers, around communities that are struggling against highways being built through their communities and with petrochemical plants, etc. But it was not until Warren County, where that PCB landfill, that toxic waste landfill, was placed in the middle of this predominantly black county. And residents in that community said no.
Thanks for listening. Going Green is a Spaces podcast story brought to you by Lines. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question, want to submit a correction, or just share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcast. That's lynes.studio/podcast. And listen in to my wrap-up episode to hear my response. If you're looking for similar content, Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content that I found during my research, you can visit lines.studio/podcast. Talk soon.